So we're in Hilchot Deot in Perek Hey, Halacha Yud Aleph. This is a really interesting topic. I have to say that I'm nervous about taping this topic, recording this topic, because it might get me into some trouble. But it's one of those topics I actually, I think it's really healthy to kind of see. First of all, welcome back to Aryeh. Good to have you home. Baruch Hashem. Okay. I think this will pretty much become apparent for itself. Maybe just a little bit of introduction. In 1948, this is actually an appropriate topic for the day after Yom HaShoah. In 1948, 3 years after the Holocaust, as hundreds of thousands of refugees were starting to pour into Israel, first illegally, and then as soon as the state was declared, so one of the first missions of the State of Israel was how are we going to make this a place to bring all these Jews home? Estimates vary, but somewhere between 300,000 and 350,000 Jews were still wallowing in DP camps on May 15th, 1948. Now, at that time, the population of the State of Israel was about 600,000. It was 600,000 Jews. So you're talking about trying to figure out a way to bring in half of your population. That'd be like America today bringing in like 175 million refugees in the space of a year and a half. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to think about it. And mind you, America has the resources to do it. We're talking about the State of Israel. Like, there's a bunch of guys who sat around and they had a yeshuv and they fought the British and now they got to run a country. Okay? That's pretty much a recipe for turning this place into a fourth world country. The fact that that didn't happen is an amazing story in and of itself. But one of the details of that situation was that, there was already a parliamentary system and they had different parties. And you can imagine, there were a couple of religious parties. Whatever the word religious means. And those parties approached David Ben-Gurion and said, look, there are very few boys, very few men today who are yeshiva students who could sit and learn Torah. Now we're talking about sort of the end of the Independence War. The Independence War ran really from November 1947, if we don't want to get into specifics, until almost 1950. Okay, pretty much the beginning of 1950. I think the ceasefire was signed sometime in the summer of 1950, if I'm not mistaken, but don't hold me to that. And then the dust starts to settle, and they got to figure things out. Now, there's a compulsory draft, and many of the ultra-Orthodox, although some resisted, but many people who you would today think are Haredi because they walk around with a black hat or a beard or served in the army. You can find a lot of 70-year-old men in Meir Shearim who fought in 1948. Because it was a war for survival, and Abba Larga Chash came Largo. If they're trying to kill you, it certainly happened, but not all of them. Anyway, so they got Ben-Gurion to agree that there should be a p'tur, there should be an exemption for a boy who's sitting and learning Torah all day not to have to go to the army. And Ben-Gurion agreed. And I have to say that in 1948, that made a lot of sense. There were sach kol about 300 boys who were sitting and learning in yeshivot here in 1950. There were no yeshivot. There was Bnei Brak Panovich. There were a couple of small places in Yerushalayim, right? I mean, that was it. How many yeshivot were there? Yeshiva back then was 20 guys, right? And we were living in a period that had seen Torah decimated. I mean, Rebbeim, Talmidim, yeshivot were massacred. There was, the Mir was such an amazing story because it was that rarest of stories where the yeshiva survived. All of Slabodka was wiped out, everywhere. So that made sense. By the summer of 1988, and I only know this because my wife did some research on this at the time, that number had swelled to about 26,000. Today they estimate the number is close to 50,000. And if you consider what little you know about the demographics...
Israeli citizens or just people learning Torah in Israel?
People learning Torah who are Israeli citizens and exempted from the army. Okay? And again, the labels always I struggle with, but for the purpose of this introduction, I think the label is important. So whatever term you choose to use, ultra-Orthodox, Haredi, Dati, Dati and Torah learning, Kolelnik, doesn't matter to me. There are probably about 50,000 guys today. And this creates a tremendous...
People, let's say, come over from other countries.
Again, Israeli citizens... who would be obligated to go to the army and are exempted because they're learning in yeshiva. That's who it includes, right? So, 50,000 guys. Now, this creates a number of dilemmas. One of these dilemmas is a social dilemma in terms of why do I have to serve and you don't. One of them is a halachic dilemma. Hausig b'mitzvah pater min a mitzvah. If you're doing a mitzvah, then you're pater from doing another mitzvah. So you're learning Torah, you should be pater, right? On the other hand, there's the question of a mechamet mitzvah. You know, are you obligated to go to war, right? And then there's sort of the implications, the socioeconomic implications. You know, when you were a Holocaust survivor and you had two children and you succeeded and you wanted your two children in 1960 to be able to sit and learn Torah because your father and your brothers and your cousins and your uncles were all wiped out. And the idea that you could have two boys learning in Panovich, you know, as your revenge against the Nazis, that made a lot of sense. It even made a lot of sense economically, because to support a couple guys in Kolo with their families is doable. But as those Kolonikim are having 7, 8, I think the average per family, I have no idea how they figured this out, and I have no idea how they define an ultra-Orthodox family, but I've seen a couple studies that were reported in the Post, I don't know if they're accurate, is that the number, the average number of children in the ultra-Orthodox sector is something like 7.8. That's an unbelievable number. That means that you've got families of 15, 16, 17 children. Now imagine you have 10 children. Imagine you have 8 children, okay? Imagine that you're Chaim Shapiro, and you remember that story, but you know, you have 2 kids, and those two kids, they get married, okay? Now it's 1960, and they have children. So by 1970, those 2 kids who are averaging, let's say, 8 kids apiece, you now have 16 kids. Let's say 10 of them are guys. I don't know if that's an accurate number. So now you have 10 guys in 1970 that are sitting in Kollel. Now those 10 guys get married, right? So now by 1990, 1995, 2000, you've got 100 guys who are sitting alone in Kollel. Only the first 2 guys who were sitting alone in Kollel, their father was working and he had a parnasa to support them with. But the third generation, their fathers are Kollelnikim. Now you're up to the fourth generation. Their fathers and their grandfathers are Kollelnikim. Who's going to pay for this? So who's paying for this? The state, to some degree. And there's a tremendous poverty level, and that creates a socioeconomic problem. Okay? So I haven't vested an opinion. I'm just telling you sort of the challenge. Okay? So the Rambam, in the middle of Hilchot Deot, brings up this issue. It's an interesting question. What is this doing here? Where would you expect to find this question? Okay, you might find this Muhammad Mitzvah, but Hechos Talmud Torah. You know, if a person can learn Torah, is he allowed to go to work? If a person, should a person go to work? Like, is going to work the ideal? Or is going to work a b'dieved? Right? Like, I mean, if you could sit and learn. He wakes up one morning and he says, listen, you know what? I'm going to sit and learn 20 hours a day. I want to become a Talmud Chacham. And I sit down with Ari and we're talking, whatever, and I see, like, this guy's serious. He really wants to become a Talmud Chacham. I want to go out and I want to teach thousands of people Torah. So what do you think I would say? And let's say that we give him a bechina. We ask, Rav Nevensal to come and give him a bechina. And Rav Nevensal walks away and says, whoa, can he come teach in my? She says, whoa, unbelievable, right? So that's unbelievable. So I say, well, how did that happen? I say, well, because he started putting something into a pair of tools and all of a sudden his mind exploded, right? That's whatever it is, right? So, okay. So what do you think I would say? I want you to know. I would say, that's what you should do. I have a friend. I'm not going to mention his name because I never know who hears these tapes, but from the time I was in third grade, this kid was in Elu. He skipped a grade. Unbelievable Talmud Chacham. You know, when the Rebbe would give us in sixth grade off, and he happened to be, I was lucky enough that there were 3 of us, and he was like my chavrusa in like sixth grade already. And there was like an hour or 40 minutes, like on that Friday, I think, where we would study in school parsha, and the Rebbe would give us like some stuff, and we would study parsha, like a little chavrusa. And all the boys would sit and read parsha and maybe do a little Rashi, and he wanted to do like Medrash Me'am Loez, Yaakov Shimoni, you know, he would find Gemaras. It was unbelievable, right? He was the first person that I ever saw stump Rav Lichtenstein. He sat in a shir, in the Gemara shir. Rav Lichtenstein was giving shir. I was zocher to be in the shir. And this whole shakl of in the sugya. And he raised his hand and he said, but he asked a question. You know, he's such an eli. I didn't really understand the question. There was some sheet that he'd seen in the Mordechai, I think it was. And he leans back in his chair, tongue in his cheek. Opens up a Gemara, takes a look at Yerushalmi. Right? As we said, it means basically, you're right, this shiur doesn't make sense. Close this firm, say, we're going to give shiur again tomorrow. And the next day he explained why his name was right and why you have to look at the sugya totally differently. So that's who this guy was. I'm not sure that guy should go to the army. I'm not sure that guy should go work. I think that guy, and Baruch Hashem, he's sitting today and he's writing his farm. That's what you should do. But for the overwhelming majority of guys, it's a difficult question. But I would think, find this in the Chos Tamar Torah. What does the Rambam say?
This isn't specifically talking about learning Torah here. He's talking about the proper way to...
Well, 1 second. Let's take a look at what it says. Well, 1 second. Let's first read what the Halacha says.
Very quickly from the end of...
Well, let's see. Right. In Halacha Yud, we were talking about how a person who's balanced, remember all through Hilchot Deot, talking how you find balance in your life, right, that, you know, dat and to some degree represents a certain level of moderation and whatever it is, right, the chacham, chokhmah. So now, derech balei deya, okay? So the way of those who, so some people translate this as people of balance, people of moderation, sensible people, people with knowledge, people who get it, whatever. Sheikbalu adam melacha mefarnes dato tchila. Ve'achakach yikne beit dira, ve'achakach yisa isha. So we got three pieces here, okay? Three catalysts to the equation of developing life. Getting a job, buying a house, finding a good woman. Says the Rambam, there's actually a specific order. Now think about this. You don't know any halacha, you're not even Jewish. What would be the obvious order if you could choose the order to do these three things? Job. Now that's an interesting question. Why would you find a wife before you have a house?
Because you want to have a house your wife will agree to.
No, if you own a house and your wife doesn't like it, you can sell that and buy another one. But if you own a house, you built a house.
Think about how long it takes you to
Pardon?
Buy a house.
Pardon?
Think about how long it takes to buy a house. Most of the world doesn't buy houses.
Okay, so let's see what the Rambam says. The Rambam says, right? People who are mildly intelligent, first, they find a job, okay? Set your career, know what it is that you do, find a job, find a living, whatever that means, right? Literally, yikbalo, set, a person should set work that supports him. Ve'achakach yikne beit dira, and then he should buy a home, okay, buy a place to live. By the way, just to be clear here, okay, without going into all the details, it seems that this is not a halacha. You're not over any isir. There's no prohibition if you get married and then you look for a house. The Rambam, that's why the Rambam says derech balei deya. It's the way of intelligent people. No, it's part of Hilchot Deot. It's obviously, well, 1 second. It's part of the way the Rambam works, and Hilchot Deot in general is, I'm going to show you how to lead a healthy, successful life. If you want to live a life of moderation, right? So, if you meet this girl and she blows your mind and you get married, and you don't know what you're doing, and you don't have a job, and you know whatever, and you're an orphan, you're going to really struggle. It's going to be very hard to be successful. On the other hand, if you take your time, you find a job, whatever, in the ideal world. I'm not talking yet about what happens if you meet that person and you don't have a career yet. Do you wait 6 years to get married? That's a separate issue. But in an ideal world, an intelligent person, if he can work this out, this is what he does. This is what Rambam says. This is not, you know, Benny Friedman. It's not, you know, the American progression of, you know, let's hunt down Kolonics, right? This is just what the Rambam says. Okay, you wanted to say something, Movo? It would seem yikneh, you don't own it. Now, you have to understand, in the language of halacha, a kinyan doesn't mean ownership the way you think of it. In other words, if I'm renting an apartment, that's my apartment. And if I have a job, and, you know, you could make a case. I know a fellow who lives in Efrat many years, some of his children are married, never bought a house. He believes that economically, I want to have a discussion about this, he believes that economically it's a big mistake for people to buy homes. Because he says, you first get married, you can't afford to buy a house, so you take out a mortgage. Everybody here knows how a mortgage works, right? If you don't, you're probably discovering the recent financial crash if you read a couple of newspaper articles, right? So basically, I go to the bank, I say, look, I want to buy a $100,000 house. I don't have $100,000. I say, well, you got to put down $10,000. In Israel, it's more. And we'll lend you the $90,000, okay? But we won't give you the $90,000. We will give it directly to the company that's building the house as the house is built or whatever, it's fine. So you pay, you get $100,000, you give it to the house, you're all happy. Now, you can't pay $100,000 next week. They say, we'll let you pay this off over 30 years, but you have to pay interest. By the time you're finished with those 30 years, you will have paid off $200,000, $250,000, sometimes $300,000, right? Okay, right? So this fellow says, well, it depends, right? So this fellow, but then the interest is higher and the payments are higher and it's tougher to make ends meet, but whatever it may be. I'm not going to get into mortgage issues. So this guy feels that if you took that same $100,000, okay, right? If you rented an apartment, right, for $400 a month, whatever it is, right, and you took your earnings over the years that you're renting this apartment and you invested them, you would get a much better return, right, for your money because you're not borrowing 100 and paying back 300 doesn't know, so you'll have more money. But I have no idea. I'm not a financier. I'm not into investments or banking or economics or anything. I'm a yeshiva guy, whatever, Baruch Hashem. But whether you rent, whether you own, that's not what's taught. That's a kenyan. Okay? But you should have the ability to have your own place. In other words, I think what the Rambam here is meaning is you shouldn't get married and then start looking for where am I going to find a place to live. You shouldn't get married and say, well, how am I going to, you know, make ends meet? Like, you know, I got a great idea. I'm gonna arm wrestle for a living. Like, you know, you got to find it, right? That's what Rambam says. And then you get married. Now, this is a difficult question. Like, what if you meet a special person, right? And you're not done, you know? In the Western world, what does it mean you find a profession? It's a very strange system. In the old days, how did you find a profession? You know, your father had a profession, you chose to go into it. If you didn't go into it, you tried different professions, you found something you like, you became proficient in that profession. You want to be a shoemaker, you want to be Nebuch a lawyer, you want to be, you know, whatever it might be, right? Today, no. Today, you got to go first. And you have to study for 4 years. And you have to broaden your horizons. And you have to study liberal arts. And, you know, that's you have requirements. In Israel as well. In Israel, you don't have the same liberal arts requirement. Although in Israel, you have the army, which is a whole other issue, right? But you're still going to spend 3 to 4 years if you go to university, right? If you want to be a doctor, you have to study, you have to take a requirements in biology and mathematics and statistics and things that you're not going to need if you're a pediatrician. You're just not going to need them. They broaden your horizons. It's done a little differently in that you're working towards a major, but it's very similar. People just don't think of this, right? So, and then at the end of 4 years, then you hopefully work a little, get some experience. Then you have to go to graduate school because you don't really know anything. And then when you finish graduate school, then you're basically setting your profession. Now, if you think about it, if a guy in Israel does that, and he's 3 years in the army, and then he goes 4 years to university, and then he gets a year of work experience, and then he goes 2 years to grad school, right? So you're talking about, what, like 7 or 8 years? So now he's like 30. You know, maybe he's 27, right? So lots of guys here meet a person way before they're 27. So that's a separate question. I'm not talking about that question. The reason I'm not talking about that question is because that's a practical question. You know, if you meet someone and you know that this is the person for you and you're a halachic Jew, you can't wait 7 years to get married. It's just not shaykh, right? The Rambam is talking about a time when people were struggling with this question when they were 14 years old. Okay, I once met the Rabbanit Kapach, whose husband, Rav Kapach, translated the Mar Nevuchim originally from Arabic into Hebrew, huge Talmud Chacham, and they both come from Yemen. And she was married to him and was his wife already at his bar mitzvah. She was 11. So I was curious about this, and I later asked somebody about this, that there was without going into all the details, girls that were in Morocco, so if they weren't married, the king's men, the officers had rights to them, there were all sorts of stories there, so in order to protect these girls, they married them off very young, but they didn't live together yet, they still lived in their parents' homes, but they weren't just betrothed, they were mamash, they did chuppah v'kedushin, yeah, so they were man and wife. So usually at some point after puberty, 13, 14, they had a majjuna, whatever. What?
Still 13.
Right, exactly. So there were lots of people. If you go over it, especially in the Sephardic world, but even in the yeshivish world, like I don't know how many of them are around today, but when I was a kid, you could meet people who got married when they were 15 years old. They lived in Lublin, or they lived in, you know, Bialystok, or they lived in the shtetl, and they, you know, there was a shidduch, and, you know, you hit puberty at 13, and you're already working 2 years, you know, with your dad. He's a bookmaker, or a shoemaker, or a jeweler, or whatever. You get married, right? Because that's when the hormones start to run, and why should you have to suffer for 3-4 years in that marriage? You get married, you're going to be a shidduch anyway. Set you up earlier, right? So that's what the Rambam's talking about. In other words, if your son is 13 years old, 14 years old, at least that's my understanding. If you're 13 or 14 years old and you want to be betrothed him and marry him off, make sure first he has a profession. Figure out a way, either help him or he does it or whatever, he should have a place to live. Once he has his own place to live and he has a profession, then he should marry. In our world, it's a little different. So I'm putting aside the question of marriage because there are a lot of differences and there are a lot of halachic questions, so I'm putting that aside. But the question of profession and home very much relates to two issues. One is the order, and the other is whether a person has an obligation or some responsibility, as opposed to a halachic obligation, to have a profession. Now, how does the Rambam come to this? So the Rambam says, what does it say? It says in Dvarim, in Perakhaf, okay, so this is one of the sugyot of warfare in the army. And there are two types of warfare, without going into too much detail. One of them is called Melchemet Rashut, and one of them is called Melchemet Mitzvah. Melchemet Mitzvah is very simple to explain. It's a mitzvah. The Rambam in Hilchos Melachim explains, Al Atzar Tzarer Atchem, right? If a nation rises up to destroy the Jewish people, right? Then you have an obligation to go to war. Every Jew except for Shevet Levi has an and Kohanim has an obligation to go to war. And Afilu Chatan Michedro, Afilu Chatan Michedro, Chatan Michupato Vekala, what is it? Another pasuk ran under my head. Even a chasn in Kala. No. There was an instance in Matot where Elef Lamateh, Levim fought. That's a subject of a whole discussion, but that has to do with a different sugya. Generally, Levim did not fight. The only time that a Levi would fight is if there was pikuach nefesh. In other words, if people were coming to attack a town of Levim, Levim were allowed to fight. They had an army, Levim, but they didn't fight. They were shomrim. I mean, who do you think protected the Beis Hamikdash? Levim, right? I don't know if the melech could give a tzav to the Levim to go to war. That's an interesting question. I don't think so because he would need a navi. I don't think so. But anyway, yeah, what were you saying?
Why is it, let's say, today, like Kohanim, like Rav Noam was in the army, he's a Kohen?
No, because first of all, every Kohen today is a Safek Kohen. And second of all, the reason that Shevet Levi is Potter from going to war is because they have a Avodas Beis HaMikdash. But today you don't have the Avodas Beis HaMikdash. The second issue of a Kohen or a Levi for that member, especially a Kohen going to war, is whether he puts himself into a situation where he's going to be Metame himself. He might encounter Tumat Meit, since every Kohen today is considered having Tumat Meit, right? Impurity by contact with death. Therefore, it's not an issue. But there are tshuvos that are written about this, right? But let's not get all... Pardon?
It's not an issue. How come a Kohen can't go into a cemetery or...
How come a Kohen... No, because you don't purposely be Matame yourself.
But you're already Tame.
But when do you go to a cemetery? When does a Kohen go to a cemetery? When he's going to be Matame himself for a Shiva Krovim.
Yeah, but once
why is he allowed to do it? One second.
Well, one second.
Why is a Kohen allowed to go to a Beit Kvarot to bury his parents? Because there's a mitzvah. So the mitzvah is Docha Datuma. So if you're going to the army, it's Melchemes Mitzvah. So then, in certain circumstances, you could do it. However, if you have the mitzvah of Avodas HaMikdash and the mitzvah of Zehasa, then you didn't do it.
On that topic, once a Kohen is Tame, why can't he go continue doing as much Tumah as he wants?
That's an interesting. We're getting a little off ground here, but that's an interesting discussion. There's, I think it's a Kedushas Alevi. I'd have to go looking for this, but I think it's. I think it's a Kedushas Alevi. I might be wrong. That talks about the fact that. That talks about the fact. It's out of my head. Not much out of my head. I think it's a Kedushas HaLevi. It talks about the fact that the Mesorah of a Kohen not being Matameh is something you uphold even though Kohanim already Tameh Meis. The bigger question is not a Kohen who was never knowingly Matameh Meis, but what about a guy and he's a Kohen and he just buried his parents and you know he's Tameh Meis? And there's no paradumas. There's no reason for him not to go to Kohanim. So many posts say, but I think I said this just Levi, that the reason you don't do it is because Minhag HaVasein would be a Adenu in order to uphold the custom of Kohanim not going to the Beit Kvarot. So therefore, it's an Issur Rabbanan. But he's probably, but that's a good question. But getting back to our topic, okay? So what does the Pasuk here say? So there's two types of mitzvot. So one of them is Melchemet Mitzvah. The other is Melchemet Rashut. Melchemet Rashut is basically when the king and the Sanhedrin, the Navi, decide that it is in Israel's interest to go to war for expansionist economic reasons. Like, for example, let's say that we decide that we're going to take the mountains on the other side of the Jordan River because in order to protect ourselves, we need to control the water rights. But nobody's threatening us right now. So it'd be hard to say that that's a Melchemet Mitzvah. You would probably have to say that that's a Melchemet Rashut. That could be. I'm not a posek. Don't quote me on this, but whatever. Or let's say, for example, that we decide that there's 1 million Russians coming, and that there are Arabs in Jordan. I don't know, 70% Palestinian, whatever that means. Fortunately, you're not in Jordan right now. you know, they're not good neighbors, and we don't want them there anyway. So we kind of kick them out into Iraq, and we take over Jordan, so that there's lots of room for the Jews to live, right? So I don't. You wouldn't define that as Mohammed mitzvah. You would probably define that as Mohammed Rashut, certainly today. Okay, so this is talking about Mohammed Rashut, because for Mohammed mitzvah, there's nobody putter. You don't get to not go to Mohammed mitzvah just because you got married, but you do get to decide not to go to Mohammed Rashut. Right? And non-obligatory war before you get married. Pardon? You need a melech, and you need a navi, and you need a Sanhedrin, and you probably need a Beis Mikdash. So...
that part is pretty much a mitzvah.
Pardon? No, it's not a mitzvah. No, let's say I say, listen, I got a great idea. We have all these water problems here, and there's a lake called Agam Karun, and it's up in Lebanon. And if we had that lake, we'd have no more water problems. So we should take that lake. It's not like you take land because they have good grapes. Like you're taking land for a reason. There's a strategic reason. And, you know, there's a Muslim, prime minister of Turkey now. Why take risks? Let's take Agam Karun now before they develop nuclear weapons. I don't know, Chavesnish, right? It's a depressing topic, right? Okay. So that's what we do. I could see a posek saying that might be considered a Mohammed Rashut. Then a person who gets married might be able to halachically say, I don't have to go. But, you know, and I'm talking about the whole, I'm putting aside, there are other questions here, Dina al-Mukhut Adina, you know, does the Israeli government have the right to make decisions, even if halakhli they're not obligated, that also might be true, because you have responsibility to listen to the authorities in the country that you're in, but that's another discussion. So what does the Pasuk say? Umi Aish, Asher Erasi Shah, who is the man who betrothed the woman, this is in Perek Chaf Pasuk Zayin, Velo Lekacha, and he has not yet consecrated the marriage, right? Yelech v'yashov lebeito, let him go, and go back to his home. Pen yamut b'milchama v'ish acher yikachena, lest he die in the war, and someone else will end up having relations with him and betrothing him. You're engaged, you're married already. Ki yikach ish isha is married, but you haven't had a chance to have relations, or according to one opinion, you haven't had a chance to have children, and you don't want that you should die, and there should be no children. Someone else marries her, and he has the children. So because you're worried about that, you don't want to leave her without children, so you can leave. Right, and then there's another miayisha share. Before is that miayisha share natakerem. He who planted a vineyard velo chilalo is not consecrated, hasn't brought forth the fruit yet. Yelech v'yashov l'beito. Right, so the Rambam points out. Right, if you continue reading in the Rambam, right, what does the Rambam say? He says shenemar miayisha share natakerem velo chilalo miayisha share bana bayit chadash velo chanacho miayisha share rasi shav velo lekacha. Look at the order here. Okay. Who has planted a vineyard and not consecrated? Who has built a house and not literally? Chanukat HaBayit is. What's a Chanukat HaBayit? Dedicated it. Yeah, I guess a house dedication or consecrated it. Or live, moved in, right? And then it says betrothed, right? And by the way, there's one day that says that there's an easier way to understand this from within the Rambam. Somebody, right? If you look, he who betrothed a woman and has not taken her, let him go back to his home. So that means that a guy got married, but he hasn't yet had the relations, so he can go back to his house. That means that he already has a house. So when he got married, he already has a house. You do not have to say that in the Pasuk.
But if he doesn't have a house, he
could
still go home.
Yeah, but in a but that's what the Rambam wants to learn from. Okay. So the Rambam wants to say, basically, that, right, avala tipshin, but the idiots, fools, people who aren't too bright, people who don't think ahead, matchilin lisa isha. They start by getting married. Ve'achakach im timtzai ado. Right? And then, if he can figure it out, yikneh bayit, he'll try to figure out a way to buy a house. Ve'achakach b'sof yamav, and then later on, yechzor levakeh shumanut, then he'll try to sort of learn a profession. O yitparnes minat tztaka. He'll figure, what's going to do? I'll live off tztaka. Right? Ve'chein hu omer beklalot. And so it says in the curses, isha te'areis bayit tivneh, if you look in Perek Chafchet, okay, in Dvarim, right? So in Perek Chafchet, it says, Perek Chafchet Pasuk Laman. Perek Chafchet was that chapter that we once did, all the curses, the difficulty that I told you, right? Holocaust to me, right? Okay? Isha te'areis v'ish acher yishaglena, bayi tivne v'lo teshev bo, kerem tita v'lo techalenu. It says that one of the curses is that you'll betroth the woman and you will not be able to consecrate the relationship. Right? You'll build a house and you won't get to dwell in it. So here, the house is after marriage. And this is a curse. So the Rambam seems to imply that if you're forced, for whatever reason, to get married first and then have to go look for a house and then have to go look for a job, then you're cursed. You're going to live a cursed life. It's off. There's something, that's a problem. In other words, I curse you that you should get a house, that you should get married before you have a parnasa, before you have a house. That's like not a bracha. You know, much more a bracha that you win the lottery and you get to buy a house and then somebody says he wants to take you under his wing and train you how to be an electrician, and then you meet this great girl. It's all working out for you. You got your job. You got your house. Yalla bita, right? Okay. So that's what the Rambam seems to say here. And just to finish the language of the Rambam, v'chinu omer b'klalot ishat teres b'itivne kerem tita, right? That it says it in that order: first betrothed, and then a house built, and then planting a vineyard. Klomar yu masecha afuchim. In other words, the curse is that you'll end up doing it in the opposite order. Kedei shelo tatzliach et rachecha, in order that you don't succeed in your way. Ubabracha omer. But when the Torah tells us an example of somebody who's blessed, who's mivarach, so it says, "Vayhi David lechol drachom maskil v'Hashem imo." So if you look in Sefer Shmuel, right, when it's talking about what David succeeded in doing, so in Shmuel Aleph, in Perek Yudchet, right, in the 18th chapter of the first book of Shmuel of Samuel, so it says, "Vayhi David lechol drachom, or really lechol drachav maskil v'Hashem imo." Now, pshat is that the Tanakh here is trying to tell us that David was very successful. And in fact, Rashi here says, maskil means matzliach. Right? Vahi David maskil, vahi David lechol drachav maskil, means that he was successful. But the Rambam learns maskil from the word sechel, which means intelligence. And he says he was thoughtful. He thought things through. He was successful because he thought things through. If you think it through, smarter to first have a profession and then get married. By the way, I can tell you that the last year of smicha for me, when I was already married, was much, much more difficult. Much more difficult to be learning, to be studying. If you go to university and you finish university and then you get married, so then you have this whole university experience, and it's an experience that you don't get to taste in the same way if you get married. So that would seem to be pshat in the Rambam. So if you get married early and then you still have to earn your degree, then you get into all sorts of shilas about, you know, for example, Rav Moshe has a tshuva that's well known, that if a person wouldn't get married because he's not ready to have children, such a person is allowed to use certain types of birth control, because better to get married and fulfill the mitzvah of getting married than to not get married, right? That's what Moshe Paskins. What's the major reason that people have with that issue? That they're still studying. They don't have a parnasa yet. So you're a junior in college. You say, look, I can't have children now because how am I going to finish college? How am I going to do grad school? Right? I'm 21 years old. I'm not ready, but I'm in love. I'm halachic. I want to be married. Okay. So you get married. You use a certain type, again, the big halachic question, what you can do, what you can't do. It's not going to get into that. So this brings us now to the question, which is to think about, maybe we'll get into it tomorrow, which is, so what do you do with this? First of all, there are major, major, major gedolei Torah who not only say that it's perfectly okay for a person to sit and learn and get married and not yet own a house and not have a parnasa yet, right? So it's all well and good to say, like, we think that this is the Rambam, but, you know, I'd like to believe the Chazon Ish had a way of interpreting this Rambam, you know, knew a little more than Benny Friedman. So how do you understand this Rambam, then? How do you deal with that question? And the second question is to understand the implications of this halacha. Like, what does that mean? What's the bigger picture in terms of how I understand what the Rambam is trying to do here and why he's doing it? So we're going to get into this discussion tomorrow, Bezrat Hashem. On Thursday, Bezrat Hashem. You have a little chance to think about it and quiz your cousins. And we'll be back same time, same channel. Shkayach.